Charles, you must look at this fossil specimen that was recently sent by post.
Look at the size of it.
It recently arrived by courier, Charles. It has the appearance of a small chicken or crow.
But it's got teeth.
It's got teeth. It's got teeth, Charles.
It's got claws and a tail.
Hello, and welcome to Discovering Darwin, a podcast dedicated to the writings and musings of Charles Darwin. I don't think we've done many musings lately. Are we going to do any musings today?
We're going to muse a lot today, I think.
But are we going to talk about Charles Darwin's musings?
Mine, predominantly.
Okay. Anyway, my name is James Wagner, and I am joined every episode by my two wonderfully esteemed colleagues, Dr. Sarah Bray. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, James. You're my favorite, too.
Oh, there you go. And Josh. Hi, Josh. I like you just as much.
Hi, James. It's okay if you don't. Hi, Sarah.
Well, my extra favorite.
All right.
Okay. Dr. Josh Atkins. I just called him Josh.
And this is...
We're all on first name basis now with our listeners as well.
Truth.
Hopefully. As I said, this is a podcast dedicated to exploring the writings of Charles Darwin. We are spending this episode and this season, actually, sorry, this season to Darwin's most famous book, Origin of the Species. And each episode, we sort of explore one chapter. And this episode, we're going to explore chapter 11. Really?
Yeah, we're there.
We're there. There's only 15 chapters to go.
To go?
No, sorry. Oh, sorry. No, 15 chapters.
Is there another volume? I only have one book.
No, I was just thinking, as I was saying, I was thinking, gosh, I'm so glad they're still with me. I don't know if they realized what the dedication would be to go through this book as it has been. But yes, there's 15 chapters in total. We're on chapter 11 on the geological succession of organic beings. As you may or may not be aware, this podcast is linked to a blogspot, discoveringdarwin.blogspot.com, where you can download the episodes, but we also add some nice visuals to the blog that sort of explore and expand on the ideas that we talk about or correct some of the things that we talk about.
Never.
Actually, we've done very few corrections.
Hey, excellent.
Yeah, which might mean that I really don't know what we're talking about.
or we have really poorly paid fact checkers.
There's probably that too. But this episode, we're going to work on the chapter in which Darwin, in my mind, this is what I get. Darwin says, okay, here's my model for evolution by natural selection. And if it's correct, let's retrofit it to the fossil record.
Yes, Darwin needed to be able to rectify his thoughts and at least bridge this gap between biology and geology.
Yeah, and I think the last podcast we kind of talked a lot about what was troubling to Darwin about the fossil record, but I think this chapter actually does a better job of saying why the fossil record actually works well with his theory.
Yeah, and he at the time was dealing with a fossil record that is not as impressive as it is today. So I think what's most intriguing is in this chapter he makes a couple of predictions. He basically says this is what should happen in the fossil record. And now we have a lot of data to sort of test that idea. And it, not surprising, spoiler alert, it actually confirms what he thought. But let's start off with one of the biggest ideas that he explored in this chapter. So Darwin brings up a bunch of different ideas in this chapter, but we all agreed that one of the major ideas that he introduces is this concept of extinction, where the evidence of organisms in the fossil record suggests that they do not exist anymore. And I have a quote here from page 449, and he says, "On the theory of natural selection, the extinction of old forms and the production of new and improved forms are intimately connected together. The old notion that all the inhabitants of the earth having been swept away by catastrophes at successive periods is very generally given up, even by those geologists." And then later he says, "On the contrary, we have every reason to believe from the study of the tertiary formations that species and groups of species gradually disappear, one from another, first from one spot, then from another, and finally from the world."
That's really sad.
It is. So, but, you know, in contrast to the other alternative model of transmutation of species, that is the fact that species could change, is Lamarck. we didn't really talk much about Lamarck, but Lamarck proposed that species do change in response to the environment, but in Lamarck's model, species just improve. There is no extinction. It's sort of a linear change in their historical progression. But Darwin is saying, no, extinction's actually integral to my model, which I think is a quite dramatic difference.
And it sort of goes against this notion of divine creation, right? This is one of the more controversial ideas in the book, I guess, at the time. This idea that a species may have been created imperfectly, and thus it did not last, it did not stand the test of time, and now it's extinct.
He was saying, hey, my model says extinction should occur, and that's in contrast to a supernatural being occasionally causing catastrophes and making things go extinct. Right? There's a difference in his model versus what the people thought
versus,
at the time.
Hey, there's Noah's flood, and maybe there were a few other floods that we didn't hear about.
Right.
Right?
Right. But I guess my point is that the fundamental difference is that Noah's ark, the biblical flood, didn't result in extinctions, right? Because species were saved.
Unless they didn't get on the boat.
Right.
I guess that's true. We don't know which ones didn't get on the boat.
Yeah.
Oh, we do. They're in the fossil record. So that's how most people interpreted the fossil record.
Ah.
So those who did not get on the boat, I guess like clams, lobsters,
why were
and corals.
They affected by floods.
But they were wrestling with this notion of things go extinct because of floods or catastrophes. And God was the source of those floods or catastrophes. But that's in contrast to Darwin, who said extinction is actually a process he would predict.
He also goes on to say, the extinction of species has been involved in the most gratuitous mystery. Some authors have even supposed that as the individual has a definite length of life, so have species a definite duration.
That's on page 450. Thank you, Chuck. He's basically trying to figure out, based on the fossil record, how long things persist. So we shouldn't be surprised things go extinct?
No, because, you know, we don't know a lot of things.
But does Josh propose that, did you say extinction's bad?
I was thinking it. I think you're reading my mind.
Well, I think we do question this. And, you know, currently we live in a world in which we see the concept of extinction quite differently because we're starting to see human influences on species persistence.
I've even heard people give it the geological era type name.
Right, Anthropocene.
Yeah.
That we live in an era now where the rates of extinction are greatly influenced by humans alone. Where I guess historically, in Darwin's time when he was looking at the fossil record, we would argue that the rates of extinction, the fact that extinction occurs, is due to some extraneous factor. It could be climate change, like glaciation.
Could be.
Or these external factors, right? The classic ones of external meteorites hitting the Earth. The Yucatan event that caused supposedly
the reason why there's not sentient dinosaurs today.
Yeah, well, they are. They're called birds.
Well, sentient or, you know.
You're talking about dinosaur people.
I'm talking about dinosaurs.
So the fact that we have extinctions today, are you saying that we look at them differently than Darwin looked at extinctions in the 1800s?
I think so. I think that, you know, today we're maybe a little more cognizant of the tremendous impact that human activity can have on biological diversity. And we, even if we can't slow down a lot of the mechanisms that are causing extinctions, we at least recognize that it's happening.
I think it's kind of interesting to think about, you know, today as we look at the fossil record, that we can look through periods of time where it seems like maybe there's a pretty good balance between extinction and the creation of new species so that we don't see, you know, large increases or decreases in total numbers of species. But there's certain times in the fossil record where we just see decimation, death, everybody goes away, right? And those are often called the five big mass extinction events. And that seems to be something that goes beyond just the main things that Darwin is talking about, which is that day-to-day battle for these limited resources, right? And that's kind of that background rate of extinction that we see all the time.
Okay, so you're saying that when we say the word extinction, there's two kinds of categories. right?
Well, you know, extinction's extinction in some ways, right? You're dead, you're dead. But I think when you think of it in the context of the entire ecosystem or world, you have very different rates at which it can happen, mm-hmm. right? And so some people have argued that you both of you brought up this Anthropocene is an example of the sixth great extinction. And in fact, James, I believe you read a book about that for our first year course.
Yeah, first year seminar.
Yeah.
And it has been articulated that we are living in an era of, so they make the distinction between mass extinctions.
Right.
Right. And extinctions.
Yeah, exactly.
So if Darwin's model is correct, you've got this process that sort of, I kind of envision this pool, right? Where water flows in. And water flows out. Mm-hmm. And the water flowing in is creating new species, right?
Yeah.
And then the water flowing out is extinction.
Yep.
Do we have a sense that historically, let's ignore what's going on right now, but historically, has the water flowing in outpaced the water flowing out? In other words, do we create more species creation is happening at a faster rate than species extinction?
I think when you look at the really long scale, right, mm-hmm. that we do see the number of species increasing, right? So the pool is filling up,
okay.
Right? The pool is getting deeper.
And then occasionally something comes in and whacks it,
right?
Pulls the plug, everything falls down, and then we reset it.
Exactly. But then it creeps back even above where it had been prior to that massive deluge, if you will.
And what are some of the reasons that these mass extinctions have gone on in the past, right? We mentioned meteorites, the Yucatan catastrophe where a very large meteorite hit off the coast of the Yucatan. And within 9 minutes of that impact, supposedly all the forests in eastern United States were on fire.
Yeah.
Think about that. Eastern United States. We're talking Florida up to Canada in 9 minutes.
65 million years ago.
Yes. 65 million years ago.
Yeah. So this is the classic, if you ever watch something about dinosaurs, mm-hmm. The Brontosaurus is grazing,
and it looks over its shoulder.
Exactly. And the sky is on fire.
Yeah.
There's a hole in the sky. And you look up, if you're that dinosaur, if you looked up at the path of the meteorite, you would be looking out into outer space because this incoming object is obliterating and displacing the atmosphere as it's coming in, faster than a bullet being shot from a gun.
And it was so massive that we can actually see across the globe evidence of this in terms of a really thin but dark layer that separates the Cretaceous period, which was when the dinosaurs were predominant, from the Tertiary period, which is really the time of the mammals, right? And so when you think about that, across the globe, there was this basically soot line, right, that has been fossilized. That's pretty wild.
And then on top of that, so if you ever seen like a slow-mo video of somebody getting their face slapped or punched, right? So they whack on one side of their face and then, you know, this wave of energy flows across their face, and on the far side of their face, it goes wah, 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 wah. Their cheek kind of flows out of their face. That's what happened to the Earth. So in the Yucatan, bam, you punched it. And then over in Siberia, volcanic activity increases dramatically and you get this spewing out of magma. Lava.
I'll recommend a book that I really enjoyed, and we may have to correct this on the blog later. I think it's called Under a Green Sky, and it's a book that talks about mass extinction events, but even more importantly, I think it really shows how the process of science works, which is that when the Alvarezes, which were a father and son team, came up with this hypothesis that it was an asteroid that really caused this mass extinction event that killed the dinosaurs, people didn't accept it. There was a lot of rejection in the scientific community. Eventually, everybody came around, and then everybody thought every extinction was due to an asteroid hitting the Earth. And so the greatest extinction ever was the Permian extinction. And it's been estimated up to 95% of marine species went extinct at that event. And so people were kept trying to find evidence for this meteor, and a study came out. Anyway, you should read the book. It's very cool. In the end, the Permian, we feel pretty confident today, had nothing to do with an asteroid.
Oh.
That in fact, it was a really massive climate change event that eventually led to these sees lacking oxygen, anoxic seas. The reason for the green sky was because of all the byproducts produced by these anaerobic microbes that basically gassed out everybody. So it's, you know, there's a lot of different ways, but usually these mass extinction events are something that you survive it out of just like crazy luck. Like almost everybody's going to wiped out because it's such a massive change.
But at that time period, am I correct to think that most of the life was still aquatic? There wasn't a lot of terrestrial life?
It was mostly, there was some.
Some terrestrial primitive plants stuff, and some arthropods that were scrambling around.
But if you think about like Nautilus, right? Ammonites go extinct, but they look kind of like Nautiluses. Those of you, James, I'm sure we'll put a picture on the
website. I have a collection of shells from them. I'll photograph that.
Yeah. So there are these shelled cephalopods, right? Mm-hmm. So think of a squid or a octopus, but in a kind of snail type shell. And they just got decimated,
isn't it? So going back to your point, Josh, why do we think now that the extinction events that we see today are distinctly unique from what historically has happened?
It's happening at a rate that far outpaces the natural, I guess, background rate of extinction.
So even though the meteorite that we just talked about, that would exceed the background rate, obviously.
Yes.
But you're saying it's similar to that what we're seeing today?
Yes, in terms of its scale, but
so what is it that we're doing that's causing the extinction? Is it hunting? Are we overhunting things?
There's been a little of that. A lot of it is habitat destruction, right? So we are altering habitats. We are changing the climate, which again, many mass extinction events are associated with massive climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, during Darwin's time, you know, he was a naturalist, and he was along with lots of other naturalists at the time, going around the world looking for exotic plants to bring back to the Queen's England, right? And sometimes when you bring an exotic plant in its native soil, so exotic soil, you also bring back some fungi or some other type of potential pathogen.
And root-sucking insect.
Exactly. And so we began moving things around the planet then, and we're even better at it now. And that's another cause for widespread extinctions, this introduction of invasive or exotic species.
Right. Well, one of the things that Darwin points out is that once something goes extinct, we never see it again, which I think he believes is a distinctive characteristic of his theory in contrast to, you know, what is he, you know, arguing against? He's arguing against the special creation model. And there's no reason in the special creation model that God couldn't just recreate something after making it. But in Darwin's model, he argues that once something goes extinct, it itself is gone. You might find something similar that kind of plays the same role, but it won't be the exact same species. Which is like I said before, one of the things I find intriguing about this chapter, he makes very strong predictions. If my model's correct, this is what we'd see.
And I think we talked about this in the last podcast as well. If you rewound the tape and play it again,
right,
what would happen? It's kind of a similar thing, right? Which is that, okay, well, that thing got wiped out, but that niche in the environment is still open. And so something's going to fill it, but we're going to see, because of its own idiosyncratic past, it's going to have these unique characteristics that make it, it's similar to that thing it's replacing, but it's not the
right
same.
Is it going to be a sheep or a kangaroo, right? They both sit there and graze grass and move through the fields, but they're quite different.
Is it going to be a lion, or is it going to be a saber-toothed cat?
Oh, yeah. Good point. All right. So what we've established is that Darwin embraces extinction in his model, and not only embraces extinction, but says it's integral to his model, which is sort of a contradictory view of everybody else at the time.
Yeah.
And he goes back to your question, Josh, is extinction a good thing? I guess Darwin would say it's neither good or bad, but it's needed.
It's inevitable.
It's inevitable. That's probably the best way to look at it. Yeah. All right. The next section we're going to talk about is affinities of past organisms to present organisms.
You're listening to Discovering Darwin.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to Discovering Darwin. We're going to now sort of explore the idea that Darwin presents that he actually calls the subtitle of this section, On the Affinities of Extinct Species to Each Other and to Living Forms. And I'm going to give you a quote on page 461. He says, Let us now look to the mutual affinities of extinct and living species. All fall into a few grand classes, and this fact is at once explained on the principle of descent. The more ancient any form is, the more, as a general rule, it differs from living forms. So Darwin is basically saying, hey, look, I look at the fossil record as clear evidence of my idea of evolution by natural selection, and more importantly, evolution by descent, that organisms always come from pre-existing organisms, which I think is pretty, you know, bold statement on his part.
Does it also follow that, I guess it says plainly that the forms that are alive today are more closely related to one another than they would be those ancient fossilized forms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he's writing now, and I think, Josh, I'd like you to read this quote where he introduces, it's a very exciting fossil that we didn't talk about in the last episode, which is transitions, but we'll talk about it.
Excuse me. Even the wide interval between birds and reptiles has been shown by the naturalist just quoted to be partially bridged over in the most unexpected manner, on the one hand by the ostrich and extinct Archaeopteryx, and on the other hand by the Compsognathus, one of the dinosaurians, that group which includes the most gigantic of all terrestrial reptiles.
It's on page 462. The Compsognathus.
Compsog. I like to pronounce the G because here's why.
Why?
When I was in fifth grade, I read Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton, and it was far above my reading comprehension level at the time.
But it was a fat book.
But it,
so
was,
you looked
it was
really awesome, didn't
well,
it?
Well, and I made it all the way through. And I remember that the compies, as they called them in the book, colloquially, were these tiny little dinosaurs that were essentially in the book. Now, this is just in the book. They were essentially scavengers. They were tiny pack scavengers. And I remember that toward the end of the book, they took down, I believe it was John Hammond, but in the movie, they kill someone else. And I don't remember who it was.
And they're tiny little dinosaurs.
I didn't remember that.
And that may have been Jurassic Park 2. I'm getting my original.
But you didn't tell us why the G has to be pronounced.
Because I was in fifth grade and I didn't know that the G was silent.
Oh, okay.
And Darwin doesn't know that either.
That's right. Well, so the Archaeopteryx is, I think it's an amazing contingency of history here.
Now, I know I've heard this word Archaeopteryx before. What is it?
Well, so this is, like I was saying, a great contingency of history. So 1859, Darwin publishes this idea that species change, the mutability of species. And the British scientists accept and reject it. And there's a big, you know, flurry of thought about that.
Harumph.
You're wrong. You're right. So in 1862, there is this amazing fossil found in Germany. So in Germany, there's a quarry where they pull out limestone. And this limestone is used for lithography, which is a printing process. And the limestone is very well sought after because it's very, very fine-grained limestone. And that means that when you want to make an engraving and create a lithograph, you can do very fine resolution of your lines and your details. So this limestone has is very fine, and in it are often found fossils because that area of Germany, 160-odd million years ago, in the Jurassic era, Josh, shout back to your Jurassic Park.
Life finds a way.
Yes, it does. So in Germany, 160 million years ago, that area of Germany was a lagoon, an archipelago that sort of butted up against a shallow sea. And if you can imagine, you know, I think of, say, mangrove swamps that are estuaries that we snorkeled in Belize or that I've seen in Florida. But even deeper, these mangrove swamps are even deeper because the ocean doesn't get to go up into those swamps and flush out the water. So the water becomes stale, becomes highly saline, very low in oxygen. And there's trees and there's this stuff. And organisms will fall in the water and they won't decompose. We've talked last episode about fossilization. And the organisms get trapped in those sediments and get ultimately created into fossils. But more importantly, that fine sediment creates the very high quality limestone that people saw.
Is that limestone or is it shale?
It's a shale limestone kind of thing. You're right. And within this limestone, they would quarry it for lithograph material. And there was a doctor who worked there, a physician named Carl Haberlein.
Haberlein.
And he often would take, instead of payment for his services as a doctor, he would accept fossils because he was an amateur naturalist.
You could pay me in rocks as long as there are dead animals in them.
Or plants.
Or plants. Or plants. I'm sorry to be so biased.
Yes. And what's cool is that in that quarry, they were finding fossils. We've talked about this last episode, how hard it is to fossilize delicate creatures because of the fine sedimentation. And sometimes the lagoon would kind of dry out, and so it'd be kind of sticky, muddy thing. Mm-hmm. And so lizards or small dinosaurs would cross it and get stuck, and then they would die there. It created a vast array of very interesting fossils, jellyfish even, soft tissued animals.
Wow.
And also, you know, big boned animals. So not too big, but the most important big boned animal.
Medium boned animals.
Medium boned animals. Oh, my God. Anyway, so this doctor has a huge array of fossils. And one of the things that he comes across is a fossil of a feather, which was the earliest evidence of what we now know as birds. The next thing that he gets is this really intriguing fossil. So the scientist looks at the fossil, and he names it Archaeopteryx, which means ancient wing, and Lithographica, in reference to the stone that's used for lithography. And this fossil is an amazingly beautiful fossil, right? It's got this long neck. The head of the bird has teeth. The wings of the bird.
Josh is posing for us.
Oh, thank you, Josh. That looks frightening. The wings have claws on them. And more intriguing, the tail of this bird-like creature is very long lizard-like tail.
Wait a minute, James. Are you suggesting to me that this Archaeopteryx, air quotes, is somehow a transition between
some kind of lizard bird?
Lizards and birds.
Yes.
Because modern birds don't have teeth. I've checked.
They don't have teeth. Though, interestingly, they have the genes to make teeth, but the genes themselves have been sort of blocked by mutations.
I can't see that, so I don't believe in it.
Okay. But they do. So here's where it's interesting to me. So a German quarry, they find this beautiful transition form, like you said, Sarah, just 3 years after Darwin first publishes Origin of Species, this is like the smoking gun, mm-hmm. right? This is the best evidence of a transition form. It's a hybrid between lizards and birds. The first guy to describe it gives it a name that's bird, Archaeopteryx, wing. So he basically believes it's a bird. But the German scientific community says, no.
Nein.
Yes, they say nein. We do not believe in evolution, and we do not believe that this is a hybrid. This is clearly a lizard. And they call it that. The physician who owns this fossil and about 1,700 other fossils, he decides he needs to sell them because his daughter needs to get married and he needs money for a dowry. So he decides to sell these fossils and puts them up for sale. At first, he doesn't let anybody see this, you know, supposed hybrid between reptiles and birds. And then there was this big stink that maybe it was a total farce or
fake,
right. So then he let people see it, and there was interest in it. And but the Germans and the German scientific community, in fact, the lead German scientist was a zoologist at the Munich University, who interestingly has a name, J. Andreas Wagner.
Oh.
Yeah. He totally did not accept evolution. A different Wagner, obviously, than me.
Obviously, of a far lesser stock.
I don't know. He published a lot. But he did not believe in evolution.
But he published in low-impact journals. Dear James.
Dear James. So, nonetheless, he convinced the German government and others that this fossil was not worth their time or money. And the British Museum bought the fossil for £450.
That seems like a lot of money, but I don't even know how much a pound is in US dollars today. Is a pound like $2?
It's 1/2000th of a ton.
Fair enough.
No, okay, Josh, I agree with you. And so I did some research. And so in that period of time in the 1800s, you could hire a maid to live in your house and work for you for a year for £9.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he got 450 pounds just for the Archaeopteryx fossil.
So you could either get this fossil or employ 50 maids.
That's right.
Okay.
For a year. Or one maid for 50 years.
Yeah. No, you don't want to.
You gotta get.
Yeah, you gotta have 50 maids. No, not just one.
But that gives you a sense of the value that the British Museum thought and saw in this fossil. And it wasn't quite complete. They actually found multiple other Archaeopteryx fossils. And actually one of the most beautiful ones now is in Germany. So they got a more complete, intact Archaeopteryx fossil. But I thought it was really funny, right? You have this differentiation in the view of the value of this concept of evolution. And because of that, it drove them to see the value in this fossil.
I think it's interesting too, because, you know, you talk about the guy who named Archaeopteryx was Owen, who was a very famous anatomist.
Actually, it was Meyer. It was a German that first named it.
Okay. Well,
but then Owen got the fossil.
Who, like,
right.
Described it.
Yes.
Like,
totally agree with you on that.
He was like kind of in a rush. Like he did kind of a rush job to describe it. I don't know. I guess for priority and those kinds of things. He did say, hey, this is a bird. So he put it firmly in the bird category. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing is he got some stuff wrong. Like he thought he was looking at the top of the bird, but it was really the bottom. Some things like that, right?
Dorsal and ventral are pretty tough.
Yeah, but yeah. You know, it's a little difficult. The other thing that's interesting about that is that Huxley, who we've probably talked about before. Mm-hmm,
a little bit.
You know, this issue of transitional species and the fossil record was the one thing that Huxley was pretty worried about in terms of the theory of evolution. You know, I found this some writing of his where he had talked about, well, you know, essentially we kind of try to wave away all these problems with the fossil record. And we say, oh, you know, it's not enough time, or oh, things don't fossilize. And so he said that we say that that the series of formations with which we are acquainted is but a small fraction of those which have existed, and that between those which we do not know are great breaks and gaps. I believe that these excuses have very great force, but I cannot smother the uncomfortable feeling that they are excuses. And so this was in 1968, so this is a little bit later on.
Right, wait, 1868.
Sorry. Yes.
Wow. Darwin and Huxley lived a long yes. life.
Well, they got, you know, the flux capacitor outfitted and came forward. But so Huxley himself later also worked on the Archaeopteryx and described it himself, and he firmly identified reptilian characteristics that Owen kind of missed in his haste.
What are reptilian characteristics?
Well, teeth, right? Claws.
Okay.
Tails.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. That birds, you wouldn't expect birds to have.
Well, the funny thing is if you really look at birds today, you're like, they are kind of like a barely reptile. Look at their feet. They're covered in scales. Yeah.
They are
lay
scaly.
Eggs.
And the way they move their heads.
Yeah.
Like, that's true.
That,
yeah.
Like, they behave kind of.
Well, we now recognize them as modern dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs. Exactly. Yeah. And I don't know if you two have experienced this, but I've experienced real, reticence by students to accept that, say, Velociraptor had feathers. And the reason is entirely because of the legacy of dinosaur movies. No, mm-hmm. No dinosaur movie has ever had a feathered dinosaur. Even though
even
if you look
new,
at art,
even the Jurassic?
Yes. Even the new Jurassic.
Hmm.
Even though it, and there's a really clever explanation, just one throwaway line in that movie where, the guy from Law and Order, Special Victims Unit, Wong, says, oh, yeah, we know that this isn't really how they're supposed to look, but we used some frog DNA and we didn't expect or things that we didn't expect happened.
Oh.
Or I thought they might be sick, but nobody wants to see feathers on dinosaurs, so we just carry
that. That would have been even better, but, that's a complete aside. I have experienced a real rejection of artist rendering of dinosaurs with feathers.
But they've, in the last 5 years, easily, they've found some beautiful examples of that, right? From China that we talked about, the Chinese fossils.
There's a great paper where, you can see photos of an ulna of Velociraptor with the structures that modern birds have that where their primary feathers rest.
And the attachment points?
Yeah, the attachment points of those feathers.
Cool. We'll put that on the blog. So that's up to you, Josh, to find that.
Okay. I have it in my BI, biological interactions folder.
So what we're saying, though, is that Darwin says, hey, my prediction is that creatures that you see in the fossil record should be linked to things you see today. And then, you know, a couple of years later, the most beautiful version of that is the Archaeopteryx.
And Darwin said you would expect to see these types of transitional forms. And I would have loved to have been in the room when someone said, Charles, you must.
Yes.
A letter came for you, Charles. You must read it.
Well, I agree with you. And I think I'm shocked that. Okay, so in the fourth edition of Origin is when Archaeopteryx was known to the British scientist. And he mentions it there. And in the sixth edition, if we go back and look, I mean, it's a really, I think it's a paltry comment.
I know. It's surprising that he doesn't do more with it, really. Yeah. Like, you think you're like, yeah, I told you so.
So I know, to me, this is like the most clear opportunity for him to brag and to say, look, I predicted this and here it is.
So have we found more transitional forms in our modern time?
So, Josh, one of the major transitions and splits in the evolutionary history is between reptiles and mammals. And if you ask most people, you know, what makes a mammal different from a reptile, they'll say hair. We've got hair. We've got mammary glands for feeding our young, which gives us the name mammals. But most people don't actually recognize that the real distinction are ear bones. It's not the soft tissue of mammary glands or the fact that you give live young, which is not true because platypuses and echinids give birth to eggs.
And some snakes give birth to live young.
Right. So the live young issue is not a real. So if we look in the fossil record, basically they drew a line in the sand and said, if you've got ear bones, you're a mammal. If you don't have ear bones, you're a reptile. Because they didn't have all the soft tissue to look at. And that distinction between what becomes an ear bone from the jaw bones, because that's where they evolved from. So our jaw bones are simplified down to two. Whereas if you look at a snake or other reptiles, there are multiple bone segments in the jaw. So my point being is that these transitions are well established in the fossil record, not just Archaeopteryx. All right. So Darwin has made a really good effort to sort of link organisms in the fossil record to things we see today. And he says that fits with my model. You would expect that, descent with modification. And that you would see that organisms in one strata would be very similar to the organisms in the next strata. And they'd be very dissimilar to organisms in strata, you know, around the world. And his model makes that prediction, and that's what we see. So he does a nice job on that. Next segment, I'd like us to talk about this concept of ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
Ooh, what does that mean?
It's fancy talk. Yeah, it's a scientist being fancy when we talk.
The kind of fancy talk you can expect when you're listening to Discovering Darwin.
Welcome back to Discovering Darwin, and we're on the final segment of this chapter where Darwin is using his model of evolution by natural selection to explore and explain the fossil record that he had at that time. And I want to open up this last segment to a very controversial concept, but Darwin starts it off with a quote, and he says, Agassiz and several other highly competent judges insist that ancient animals resemble, to a certain extent, the embryos of recent animals belonging to the same classes, and that the geological succession of extinct forms is nearly parallel with the embryological development of existing forms. That's on page 473. Two things about this quote that I think is interesting, or maybe three, but I'll mention two. So Agassiz is an American biologist who totally rejects evolution and in fact worked emphatically to sort of discredit Darwin's idea of evolution by natural selection. And Darwin knew that, and I think it's always intriguing that he quotes him.
And he does it multiple times. This is not like the first time we've seen him.
Right. So I wonder if it's sort of, I would love to.
Like just needling him.
Or is it, you know, I think there's this, you spoke about this before, Sarah, that Darwin worked really hard to talk to other people to get them on his side, yeah. to sort of write letters and sort of basically charm them mm-hmm. to accept his theory and be, you know, vocal supporters of his theory. I don't know. I don't know what's going on here, but he quotes Agassiz and basically is saying, hey, Agassiz says, if you look at the embryos of organisms, they give evidence of their ancestral past. What does that mean?
It reminds me of something I read in a textbook when I was an undergraduate, this concept of ontogeny recapitulating phylogeny.
What does that
That's
mean?
Fancy that, talk. That's
that is fancy
good
talk.
Science fancy talk.
That is good science fancy talk. What that means is that the development of an embryo.
Ontogeny.
Ontogeny. Sort of resembles or it is
calls back
to this notion of evolution. In other words, you, James, I'm looking at you specifically. You used to have gills.
Oh.
You had a tail. You were like a tiny little fish at one point in your life.
I wish you all could see this right now. Yeah. He's like scolding him about his tail.
You, James White.
That's true.
You,
as an embryo, as an early fetus. Right? The early yes. developmental stages of my fetal
yes.
life.
You were a tiny little fish.
And I did have a coccyx, a tail, which I still have today, but it's quite lean.
It's quite reduced.
Yes. And then sometimes they have to actually cut them off on people.
Looking for the gills.
You know, comparison is the thief of joy. Don't worry that your coccyx, don't worry that your coccyx is smaller. I'm sorry. You can take that out.
I love.
Anyway, so what Darwin is referring to is this notion that your development from a tiny embryo to your final form, your adult stage.
Adult metamorphosis.
Exactly. Your final instar.
Yes.
It is a look at your evolutionary history in fast forward.
So hopefully this is an odd chapter and we've struggled with it because there is a bunch of little points to it. But for me, the big issue on this chapter is that Darwin makes predictions about how his model makes sense of the fossil record. And I think we would all agree that that's held up, right? That the organisms that disappear, go extinct, never reappear, right? And that organisms in one strata are really closely related to organisms in the next strata, that we see this contingency, and we also see the affinity of organisms from the past to the present, where there are descent with modification.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can see clear representations of it in the fossil record.
Yeah. So he spent the last chapter talking about why the fossil record might be difficult to give us a good, is not, I think you said, Josh, last episode, it's not a very reliable witness. But then this chapter, he says, look, of the witness that we have, it fits my model better than the alternative.
Yeah, at the end of the last chapter, he has that wonderful quote where he says, you know, it's like we're reading part of a novel poorly translated, and we're only getting every other chapter. I'm paraphrasing. But mm-hmm. we're not getting a clear picture with the fossil record of the entire story, but you can get the gist.
Mm-hmm.
And the gist is consistent with my ideas.
Yeah, my model fits this, not alternatives.
Right.
Great. So what are we doing next episode?
Well, the last couple of episodes, we've been focusing on when things happen, the temporal aspect of evolution.
The past.
Next time we bring it into the present and we ask the question, where do these things happen and why do they happen where they happen and how do they happen and why do they happen where they happen? Next time we'll cover the geographical distribution of species.
That's chapter 12.
And we're getting so close.
And 13. 13 is geographical continued.
Are we going to try to tackle this all in one? Or are we going to split this up again?
I think we should do both of them together.
Okay.
Because it says chapter 13, geographical distribution
part one
continued.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so next time we'll be discussing the geographical distribution of species. We've been devoting some time to when these species lived on the planet. Now we'll talk about where they live.
Yeah. And actually, I think for me, this is an exciting chapter because he's got data that you can look at today. It's not like interpreting past data.
Right.
And it makes sense in his model and not others.
And he actually presents it in two chapters, doesn't he?
Well, he gets a little wordy.
No, not Chuck.
Yeah, well, he didn't have an editor. All right. Well, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to you joining us next. I think it's going to be a twofer episode, right? Twofer? Do we all agree? Twofer.
We're going to try.
We're going to try.
No, we will.
Do or do not.
That's right.
There is no try.
We will do both chapters in one episode, regardless. Well, I hope you'll join us.
Our episode.
No, no, no.
We'll need two bottles of bourbon for that.
Oh, my God. We hope that you'll join us next episode on Discovering Darwin. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
If you had a tail, James, if you had a tail.
Yes.
What kind of tail would you want?
Prehensile.
Okay, so like.
So I could like pick up my glass of bourbon while I'm like reading a book.
So you'll have.
I could hold the book in my hands.
Oh, I like that.
And then I would be able to drink my bourbon.
Okay, so you'll have like a monkey tail.
Well, yeah, but a prehensile monkey tail.
A prehensile monkey tail. Okay.
So, Sarah, what is your tail doing for you? Oh, my.
Oh, my. This is a Title VII violation on tape.